Close Up, a conversation with Cara Walker. Discussion around Cara Walker's work often lands on the uncertain realm of fictional memoirs, and in turn, the memoir as a genre has been investigated in relation to both the feminist and the minority literature. Even if Walker's work can't be limited to what concerns the Afro-American history, and it is not reliable as an historical document, both the oral tradition of storytelling and the slave narratives are at the core of her historical reading and updating. We asked Cara Walker how memoirs enter her research and how they have affected and do still affect Afro-American self-representation.
I think as far as my kind of development and developing a kind of semi-research-based practice, one of the fascinations that I have had to do with, you know, the types of stories women tell, and also black women historically in the States, with the exception of Phyllis Wheatley, who was a poet, there were a number of narratives. You know, the slave narrative became a kind of a 19th century trope of, you know, factual fictionalizing, basically. I'm very fascinated by that kind of memoir, the complexities of memoir that, on the one hand, for instance, Harriet Jacobs was a slave who more or less escaped from slavery, but had so many kinds of ins and outs, so many kinds of strange dealings with her former master, and maybe was kind of a lover, and she had several children with him, but then she was in hiding for many years, and it's a very complicated tale, not the sort of rags to riches story that one might anticipate from like a Frederick Douglass, who also, you know, very famously rewrote his memoir several times because it was so popular, always slightly, you know, adjusting the focus from early childhood to, you know, something more heroic. I think a lot of the stories by and about women in that particular period, you know, when before the institution of slavery had been abolished, are extremely bizarre. They're bizarre stories that have to sort of conform to the Christian aspirations of the population at large. So the really complicated sexuality and contradictory decisions that are made, they have to fit a kind of a logic of purity or goodness, I think makes the fiction, turns the events of one's life into a kind of a fiction. I mean, I think to some extent the oral tradition still exists, and the written tradition, like, just know that the popularity of the slave narrative as an almost romantic fiction, you know, was really crucial for the sort of development of an abolitionist activist consciousness. Without the lived experiences of slaves, you know, talking about this institution, you know, people could pontificate as much as they wanted to, but, you know, abolitionists needed the real voices. When you think about oral tradition, I also think about music and, you know, the sort of conversations within the black church, which I don't really have anything to do with, you know, with sermons and call and response, and, you know, there's like a whole legacy of storytelling that lives within the Afro-American religious tradition. There's a funny sort of genre right now. I guess it's a genre, and I haven't really been reading. It's like street lit, you know, street literature, and it is sort of ubiquitous in every, you know, 125th Street and, you know, Fulton and Brooklyn, everywhere, and bookstores in Atlanta. It's just like full of this kind of like quickly produced sort of narrative, mostly fiction, kind of, you know, in the romance porno genre. Kind of fascinating. I feel like there are definite like waves of black literary creative output, and sometimes it's linked to political awareness, you know, the Harlem Renaissance and the period in the 50s when there were a lot of sort of I don't know if they actually got a name, but, you know, James Baldwin and Gwendolyn Brooks and all of these writers were producing a lot of great work. Cleaned up before I could wake
up. In Untitled Storyboard, that narrates throughout 14 drawings and texts the ambiguous love story of a slave and her master aboard a slave ship departing the African shores toward America, Kara Walker deals with the waving and shifting ambiguity of power between the oppressor and the oppressed, between a man and a woman. Moreover, she gets closer to the entity Africa, whose land we can also see in the Unpeopled Land in Uncharted Water series. And here she comes to explain the image and the role of Africa in her work and the sense of personal longing and search for identity that come with it.
That I'm dealing with is largely, it's an imaginary Africa, so I'm too far removed from any kind of ideal, you know, or African reality. It's an Afro-American kind of question, I think, that I'm sort of proposing a lot of the times, like, what is this sort of, yeah, it's a constantly developing identity that sort of always touches back on these relationships between Africa and Europe and the Americas. And that's kind of like, you know, where I return, it's like my Bermuda Triangle right there, this sort of mythical but very, you know, potent and potentially, you know, and very real space where, you know, sort of memory and storytelling and fictions and pop culture all sort of reside. So I think with that storyboard in particular, it's kind of emblematic, I guess, of that kind of thought process where I can talk indirectly about colonialism or slavery, or use or colonize colonialism and use slavery and the props that go with it, the characters, the locations, in order to kind of make better sense of my own individuality, my own sort of contemporary experiences, my own longings or desires or conundrums. So I guess it's more like a stage set, you know, each time I come around to talk using the plantation or the slave ship or the Middle Passage or Africa or the antebellum South, each time it's a stage set that sort of resonates with different sort of ideas of, you know, of captivity or escape. It is less about history and more about, oftentimes too much about me, but very much about this kind of a trap of identity to some extent, that even if I'm sort of doing, I think it's been written in one of the texts in that group that I can't even sort of safely dream without returning to this place or being sort of caught in. And part of it is, you know, that I am sort of trapped in my own body, but and then my body has these signifiers which refer to, you know, specific places. My body has a, you know, a history and a family history that also refers to these specific conditions that, you know, return to sharecropping in the South, and which in turn a generation earlier was slavery in the South. And, you know, there's a blank space where the history that defines me, that defines my family, sort of drops off. Like, there's no sort of further specific knowledge of where we come from or what we're made of or who met whom, or, you know, there's just property and there's commerce. And then, I mean, I'm really fascinated by that kind of, you know, I don't know, five generation existential cliff. You sort of walk back and then there are no more. And yet, clearly, there was something, and that something winds up being, you know, I wind up informing that blank space with all the other sort of muck that, you know, like everything, you know, the factual accounts, the fictional accounts, the hysterical, you know, minstrel show variations, like all of that becomes a prop for filling in that memory or that blank space. The Painter in Africa was the piece that I knew I wanted right off the bat, you know, just to have a commentary between maybe this sort of schism between, you know, maybe a European vision of Africa and my attempts at kind of disrupting that with some other kind of interiority.
And again, talking about Africa and its intersection and frictions with European stereotyping perspectives, we would like you to listen to a brief extract out of the public talk between Kara Walker and Richard Flatt, hosted by the MERS Foundation.
I'll tell a tiny story, and then I'd love to ask you to respond. This work was done for the Beiler Foundation in Basel, Switzerland. And the Beiler is the classic use of primitivism in the collection. So when you walk through, wherever there's a Picasso, there's a tribal fetish figure. It's this whole obsession with the majesty of French modernist art. And this constant, like, oh, it gets even better if you accessorize with a totem. I was working at the Walker Arts Center, and I went to see this exhibition at the Beiler, and I called Brent Sikkema, Kara's dealer, and I said, is it available? And he said, oh, no, it's on reserve for the Beiler Foundation. And I said, well, if anything happens, please let me know, because I thought for a museum, it was in so many ways, it was the perfect piece. But at that time, there was also a weird label describing the work, but distancing the author from the work on the wall. There were also these gorgeous, huge posters that were available one day. I went back the next day, they had been removed. And it turned out that Mr. Beiler, when he saw the work, correct me if I'm wrong, like totally was freaked out to see his own objects included in a narrative that is looking at colonialism with a very dim eye.
The show is called Ornament und Abstraction, and the piece is called Endless Conundrum, an African anonymous adventurer or adventuress. And when I was asked to participate in the show, obviously they said, you know, you can respond to this collection, the works in the collection, and I thought it was almost too easy. Yeah, there was some kind of misgivings. I heard, not from Beiler, but through the curator, that there was some of the figures are brown paper. That was an issue. I'm not sure why, something kind of psychoanalytic about the color brown as opposed to black, and black being a more abstract, sort of invisible kind of variation on blackness than brown, which is the color that I actually am. There's a really wonderful book I'm just started reading right now called Second Skin, which is trying to re-examine the Josephine Baker phenomenon and the idea of the modern skin or the modern second skin, and how her surface became the sort of embodiment of the modernist ideal, and trying to distance her from the other sort of maybe more practical feminist readings that have been applied to her body. So, but this was kind of that, or at least a beginning of that kind of exploration. The structure of the piece was a little bit different for me, and I was very happy about it because there was and I don't have an image of this, which I would like to get, because I think there was a photograph. There's a Matisse cutout on the wall opposite. It was a sort of more sort of vague Oceana, I think it was Oceana, and you know, it had these kind of biomorphic forms on it, and it was a piece that was behind glass, so actually when you were looking at that, you would see my piece kind of like reflected in the Matisse. And in particular, and it's all very much on display at the Beiler Museum, this kind of like the primacy of the European vision, you know, or the primacy of the European ability to objectify. And the fact that it doesn't necessarily go the other way around creates this kind of, you know, inequality between, you know, who can name and claim. So in situations like that, and I think with a lot of my work, even talking about like claiming the space of painting or claiming the space of the Merit Foundation or something, it's always about, you know, what gives me the right to sort of claim or reclaim this space, and am I reclaiming it just for revenge, or am I reclaiming it for myself, or am I reclaiming it for, you know, to recolonize it, or, you know, what, you know, there's a lot of sort of questions that arise for me.
One of the recent works presented in Turin is a series of 8 gouache on paper titled 30 Strokes. In a very seductive way, Kara Walker reports the banality of evil, depicting the collective guilt and shame of a series of public lynchings throughout America led by ordinary people and documented in the Without Sanctuary series of photographs and postcards. But as usual, it is not simple and black and white as it might appear. This series is in fact also a reflection on the relation between the author and the object, on her own fears of making paintings.
30 Strokes is the name of the watercolors with the white cutouts, but the reference was Without Sanctuary. It's a little bit of a longer story because it's like 8 pieces out of a... I'd say there's a series, but they never quite went together. It's like I would think, oh, I have to finish this idea, and then I would do a bunch, and then say goodbye, and then I did another bunch. But I was just thinking about painting and object, this relationship between the author and the object. And I was thinking about it in this destructive way in relation to these lynching images and this idea of torture and destruction of the body. So that was part of a group of works. A lot of them just use text, and they aren't here because it's too overwhelming. But you know, it's like a group of 52 posters that size that have text that are about this kind of perpetrator-victim relationship, but also it's a little bit more about that schizophrenic point when they become confused for one another and the perpetrator assumes himself to be a victim, like Gaddafi, or the victim assumes some kind of mastery, you know, it's a sort of sadomasochistic relationship. So those 8 images were sort of coming from there, but they were kind of about making paintings. Like, there's something very sort of frightening to me about, like, making a painting in this painted surface and sort of applying, you know, my sort of mastery and control over, you know, the sort of blank space. But I showed Olga Without Sanctuary website. I don't know if you had a chance to. It's informative and really disturbing. It was a very potent collection archive of late 19th, mostly throughout the 20th century. There was, quite a bit of mob violence, racial violence mostly, extra legal murder, right? So somebody would accuse somebody of something, and then usually a black man would be accused of some violation of, you know, the very narrow rules that define him. For instance, demanding he get paid for the work that he had done. There would usually be an accusation, however, of rape, which is usually not true, and then a brutal all-day, you know, killing spree. The photographs are really, really powerful in that you really get a sense of how involved the community was in, you know, somebody's death. So it's not just one or two guys, or it's not just the Ku Klux Klan and masked men. It's like this is the community, and this is another member of the community. And you see, they would have picnics. You know, the newspaper would print up an article about where it was going to take place. The Atlanta Journal was famous for it, for, you know, kind of egging on the mob, saying, well, you know, rumor has it he's been moved to this town, and then everyone would go to that town. And but the images in Without Sanctuary, so they're mostly black and white, and many of them were postcards, and this is what is the other potent thing. It's not just that the community was there as a, you know, sort of witness, blind witness, it's that the photographs existed as postcards, which were then sent in the mail, until the U.S. government banned the sale of this kind of postcard, or the distribution, because they're very unsettling. Yeah.
Kara Walker took also part into the Pictures of You workshop, a 2-day exercise in the exploration of human empathy through artistic and narrative means. The workshop, rounded around the idea of narrative imagination and our ability to empathize with others, and the means throughout which the exercise took shape, were the so-called orphan photos, those nameless pictures capturing personal memories and unknown stories. We asked Kara Walker, what is the value of photographs when people decide to get rid of them, letting their memories be orphan and anonymous? What came out is a reflection on the reliability of photographs.
one becomes like the unreliable narrator of our lives, photography, and we think, oh, we have a picture of everybody and everything is complete and we can, you know, go through it, but of course we don't anticipate our own deaths, the dissolution of all of that effort. I mean, sometimes when I see archives like that, I think maybe we should have just stuck with one painting, one big portrait painting, and that stands for everything instead of, you know, hundreds of photos from every moment. There was this panel discussion once, and this art historian, Kelly Jones, was teaching, I think she was teaching at Yale, and it was a kind of cultural studies class, and I think the one of the questions her students asked was, how come there are no historical images of Black people working? But then she went on a little research campaign looking for like specific historical representations of Blacks laboring, because, you know, clearly like there's like the history and then the representations are kind of like lazy or at leisure, or, you know, there's like after work, you know, maybe like on a big pile of hay, or they're, you know, playing the fiddle or something. So she found about, you know, I mean, I think there are numbers of etchings and, you know, newspaper documentations, but as far as like paintings by artists, it's very funny. So it's a little bit like, you know, we're always on vacation. My worry is that I'll only be seen to be speaking on an African-American thing or some kind of like a woman thing, that, you know, that moment when, you know, if you imagine these people landing on the shores of the island and people come out and bring them pasta and tea because there's, you know, empathy and humanity and we see somebody suffering, we want to help them. That kind of communication, community kind of has to exist in any art viewing situation, I think, as well. It's always at risk of, like you said, sort of closing down the minute the other is perceived as a threat and not, you know, a brother. But, you know, with my work, I think maybe the complicated part is that I sort of play with that tension, or try to play with that tension of openness, empathy, and yet there's, you know, this danger that's lurking. Image to image.
Was made possible by the support of the Fondazione MERZ, RadioPapesse.org.